From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, citing previous ineffective U.S. efforts, Wednesday outlined a new approach of increased diplomatic action in an open-ended military mission in Syria that he said was conditions-based.
We cannot make the same mistakes that were made in 2011 when a premature departure from Iraq allowed al-Qaeda in Iraq to survive and eventually morph into ISIS.
Tillerson said the U.S. must achieve the full and complete defeat of Islamic State and al-Qaeda. Despite American misgivings, he said the U.S. must persist in Syria.
Ungoverned spaces, especially in conflict zones, are breeding grounds for ISIS and other terrorist organizations. The fight against ISIS is not over. There are bands of ISIS fighters who are already beginning to wage an insurgency. We and our allies will hunt them down and kill them or capture them.
He cautioned American withdrawal would restore President Bashar al-Assad and his brutal treatment of his people and provide Iran the opportunity to strengthen its position. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy Fellow in Arab Politics, Andrew Tabler, called it a comprehensive approach.
There's been a lot of speculation. There's ambiguity on U.S.-Syria policy. This seemed to lay it to rest. It was clear, made sense to anyone who follows the conflict.
He said he awaits reaction from U.S. allies. Meanwhile, Turkey has warned it will not hesitate to take action unless the U.S. withdraws its support for creation of a Kurdish-led border force. In Nigeria, two Americans and two Canadians have been abducted in the northern state of Kaduna following an ambush in which two policemen were killed. A local police official said they were helping to set up solar stations in villages in Kaduna State at the time of the kidnappings. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump, in a Reuters interview Wednesday, accused Russia of helping North Korea evade international sanctions. The president praised China for its efforts to restrict oil and coal supplies, but said Russia appears to be filling in gaps left by the Chinese. Bruce Bennett, defense analyst with the RAND Corporation, said that wouldn't surprise him.
Russia doesn't like the United States. It perceives that the Cold War is back on again. So they're going to do things which they think are going to be problematic for the U.S.
At the same time, Russia's foreign ministry criticized the one-day summit in Vancouver, Canada, on ways to maintain diplomatic and economic pressure on Pyongyang. Russia, not invited, said it puts U.N. Security Council authority into doubt and aggravates the security situation on the Korean Peninsula. In a VOA interview, U.S. U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley said she thought it's good North and South Korea are talking since New Year's.
But we shouldn't be misled by the fact that just because they've had talks about the Olympics and this is going to happen, that that's going to take away the dangerous side of North Korea. Until they actually stop the ballistic missile testing, until they actually show that they are willing to denuclearize, we have to be very careful.
In a Reuters interview, North Korea's deputy permanent representative to the UN in Geneva said his government is determined to make the Olympics successful, regarding the event to be of the Korean nation, not just of South Korea. A day after the U.S. announced it's withholding $65 million from the voluntary contribution to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian refugees, Ambassador Haley said the Palestinian Authority is not serious about peace with Israel.
Here you've got the Palestinians who are basically saying they're going to cut the U.S. out of the peace process. They're saying that they no longer want to have anything to do with us. They go and take us to the United Nations and try and, basically are very hostile in what they say and what they do. We're not going to pay to be abused.
Meanwhile, UNRWA said it will launch a global fundraising appeal to make up for the lost U.S. funding. At least one Palestinian gunman was killed in a raid by Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank town of Jenin. The Palestinian identified as Hamas militant Ahmad Jarar, son of a senior Hamas commander killed in 2002. Israel is searching for those responsible for the killing of Rabbi Raziel Sheva, a settlement outpost resident killed January 9th. Pope Francis, continuing his visit to Chile, appealed to the indigenous Mapuche people to avoid violence in their struggle to preserve their culture and land. The Pope's comment Wednesday came at a mass for some 150,000 in southern Chile. Romania has its first female prime minister. President Klaus Ioannis appointed European Parliament member Viorica Dăncilă, prime minister-designate, to replace Mihai Tudose, who quit this week after a falling out with the ruling party's leader. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon's Ambazonia separatist movement says it has no training camps in Nigeria.
We don't have military camps in Nigeria. If the Nigerian police say so, the burden is theirs to prove that our leaders they captured were actually running those camps.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. The UN says more than 13 million people in the DRC need humanitarian aid. Cape Town, South Africa, could run out of water by April 22nd this year due to drought. And Liberian President Ellen Johnson's Sirleaf Bates farewell to her people.
12 years ago, I had the privilege to address you for the first time as your president. As I speak my last words to you as president, they are simply to say thank you for the honor to serve you.
Tensions mount between Angola and former colonial power Portugal as the trial of a former Angolan vice president draws in Portugal. And Burundi's Batwa ethnic minority group says its members are still marginalized. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Cameroon's Ambazonia separatist movement says it has no training camps or military bases in Nigeria. This after a news report quoting Nigerian police sources say separatist leaders were arrested a week ago in Nigeria for operating training camps inside Nigeria. The Ambazonia secessionist movement of English-speaking Cameroon is seeking independence from the French-speaking government of Cameroon. The report quotes a Nigerian police source as saying the Nigerian government cannot be seen as harboring separatists from a neighboring country at a time when Cameroon and Nigeria are cooperating in a fight against Boko Haram. Chris Anu, the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement, says the burden of proof is on the Nigerian government.
We do not have any training camps in Nigeria, not that which I know of. Federal Republic of Ambazonia interim government. I'm sure you are aware that there are different groups which are also in the same struggle that we are in, who are using different tactics other than what or the diplomacy that the interim government uses. And so we cannot all be lumped in the same basket and be told that we are operating training camps. We have said we are not shying away from a military option, but at the moment, we have not activated that option. No, we don't have military camps in Nigeria. If the Nigerian police say so, the burden is theirs to prove that our leaders they captured were actually running those camps.
It sounds to me, Mr. Anu, that you are not denying that your movement has a military wing.
I did not say we have a military wing. I said we have that option on the table.
So has your group been able to establish contact with your leaders?
We have not been able to establish contacts with them. The Nigerian government is still holding them incommunicado.
Do you have lawyers, Nigerian lawyers or Cameroonian lawyers?
Neither the lawyers have been able to establish contact with them. Each time they are told they're going to see them, the lawyers will go there and make one demand every other time and they will leave without seeing them. And the Nigerian government has also failed to put out an official statement explaining why they will be holding them for this long without an official explanation as to why they were abducted in the first place.
The argument the police are making is that it is reasonable, they say, that because within Nigeria itself, the government has cracked down on this independent peoples of Biafra movement. So they are arguing that it wouldn't make sense to allow another, a foreign group to have a basis in Nigeria. But you are saying that you don't have military bases in Nigeria.
No, the interim government of Ambazonia has no military base in Nigeria. We have refugee camps in Nigeria. Yes, and they may be fighting the Biafra secessionists. We are not. We have nothing in connection with the Biafra secessionists. We operate refugee camps, nothing other than that. Again, and I said to you, in this struggle, there are different factions with their own different ideologies, how they go about things. But we are different. The interim government is different. We are pursuing diplomacy. But if diplomacy fails, again, we will have no option but to resort to the military option, which is yet to be activated.
Back in Cameroon, your group is involved, or you are telling the citizens of Cameroon to engage in ghost towns. How effective is this ghost town? What exactly do you mean when you tell the citizens to engage in ghost towns?
Well, ghost towns have always been a traditional means by which people in civil society vent their bitterness against the system and bring the system to its knees. Ghost towns disrupt business, and the government loses revenue, and we order people not to pay taxes to the government, and so on. And so it has been effective in the sense that right now the Cameroon government is crippled, cannot pay civil servants. And so we are sure that we continue this way, the Cameroon government cannot sponsor the war they think they can sponsor against us. We will cripple them with ghost towns. That's why we've maintained it.
What about schools in the English-speaking area? Do you encourage the students to go back to school, or what are you telling the people?
The ghost towns have not been suspended. The ghost towns will continue every Monday. Every Monday, ghost towns in all of Ambazonia. As far as schools are concerned, we have said our position with schools is that we cannot encourage any students to go back to school when over 40,000 other students are in refugee camps in Nigeria. If others go to school, what happened to those ones? What about the teachers and other students who are locked up in various prison or detention centers across Cameroon? When others go to school, what will happen to those teachers in jail and the students who are in jail? So our position is, unless the government release all of them, set all of them free from prisons, and then create the conditions necessary for the refugees to return home to be able to go to school too, we will not encourage anyone to want to send a child to school. And so that's our position right now. No schools until, number one, the military is taken away from our streets. Number two, all the detainees are freed. Number three, the refugees are back home to be able to go to school too.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Ceremonies for next Monday's inauguration of Liberia's President-elect George Mani Weah and his Vice President-elect Jua Howard Taylor get underway tomorrow, Friday. Yesterday, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf delivered her farewell message to the nation and thanked Liberians for their support, saying she was honored to serve them.
12 years ago, I had the privilege to address you, the people of Liberia, for the first time as your president. We were a nation exhausted from 3 decades of conflict. We were starting from zero with the complete destruction of our national infrastructure, a collapsed economy, and a state incapable of providing services to its people. Never did you lose hope in ourselves, pride in our nation, or the determination to persevere. It was your energy that lifted me up each day, motivated me, gave me the drive to exhaust all possibilities for the benefit of our beloved Liberia. As I speak my last words to you as president, they are simply to say thank you for the honor to serve you.
The president touted Liberia's democratic gains and consolidation during her administration.
Back in 2006, many doubted us, not certain if Liberia's democratic resurgence would last, that our newfound peace would hold. And yet, look around you. 2 peaceful and credible successive national elections, and now an historic transfer of power from one elected leader to another. Our democracy is irrevocable. It binds every future leader of this country to the will of the people. Liberia today reflects the changing face of the continent, where rule of law, human rights, good governance, and accountability are demanded by its citizens. This is Africa's future, and Liberia is one of its enviable democracies.
Noting a changing world where nations are turning inward in search of solutions to their domestic challenges, President Sirleaf called on Liberians to be more self-reliant and to take on more responsibility for the development of their country. She appealed to Liberians to put aside the divisions of the 2017 presidential election and wholeheartedly support the incoming government of President-elect George Weah.
We had a contentious, highly charged political year. I know that. But now, we must put the disunity behind us. Liberia has but one president and one government. We must dedicate ourselves to ensuring its success. My parting wish is that you will support your new government, respond to its call for action and civility, and hold it accountable. My hope is that you cherish our democracy, participate in it, respect and support its institutions, work together to address the challenges, and take pride in the success.
President Sirleaf thanked the international community, especially the economic community of West African states, ECOWAS, for their generosity towards Liberia during her administration. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, the 18th day of January. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The International Organization for Migration has warned that many people in the Democratic Republic of Congo will die if international donors do not plug the enormous funding gap that is depriving millions of people from receiving crucial humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for the Voice of America from Geneva.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is beset by widespread insecurity and escalating conflicts in many parts of the country. Extreme violence by armed groups in Kasai and Tanganyika and eastern DRC last year has pushed the number of internally displaced people in the country to 4.3 million, the largest in Africa. IOM DRC Chief of Mission Jean-Philippe Chosy says the humanitarian situation in the country has dramatically deteriorated during the past year. He says more than 13 million people will need international assistance to survive. Chosy says the UN Humanitarian Response Plan for DRC will officially be launched Thursday in the capital of Kinshasa. He says the plan calls for $1.68 billion for 2018, which is twice the amount requested last year. The additional amount is to meet the growing needs.
Taking into account the low level of funding last year, we certainly hope that donors will step up and increase their funding to make sure that we can, if not reach the 1.68 billion, at least get close to it, because the needs are there and they're well identified. And if we don't get that level of funding, then people will die. And the most vulnerable will die first, and the children will die first. And that's a fact. That's a fact.
Money from the UN response plan is divided among the many UN agencies to run their humanitarian operations this coming year. Of that sum, IOM is appealing for $75 million to urgently meet the growing needs of displaced Congolese and the communities hosting them in North and South Kivu, Tanganyika, and the Kasai. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The trial of former Angolan Vice President Manuel Vicente is expected to start next week in former colonial power Portugal. Vicente is accused of paying nearly $1 million to a former Portuguese public prosecutor to stop a corruption inquiry involving he Vicente. A Portuguese judge last week refused a request from Angolan President João Lourenço to extradite the former vice president. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai says the upcoming trial is creating tension between Angola and its former colonial power, Portugal, including a threat by Angola to cut off all Portuguese exports to Angola.
The problem is that Angola is threatening that it could cut off imports from Portugal. And this is the main question, because the relationship between the former colonial power and Angola is so strong to put this kind of imports, which becomes a lot in the budget. The question is, what will happen? There are some news around that the incoming president, Mr. João Lourenço, will meet at the new World Powers meeting in Davos, Switzerland, the Portuguese Prime Minister, in a way to set up some kind of agreement as far as concerned this problematic question.
Mario, what exactly is the new government in Angola? What is its interest in the trial of the former vice president in Portugal?
There are two different kinds of questions. First and foremost, the former vice president is a close member of the ruling party, so he still has some kind of influence close to the former president, Dos Santos. So it's not possible to someone like have some kind of a high-ranking position in the system to go on trial in a former colonial power. The second question is, if this go ahead, it can be some kind of a freeway for the former systems to go there to check out a banking account outside the court or something like that. So that is my guess. But the news which are going in the last hours, or I would say the last 1 day or two, are saying that some kind of agreement, because there will be the world meeting of the world powers in Davos, Switzerland, and Mr. President João Lourenço will meet the Portuguese Prime Minister in some way to manage some kind of agreement to this kind of problem. So the trial will be a go-ahead, maybe some I'm saying with another people related to the case, but anyway. But this is a serious case due to the trade between the former polar powers and Angola. That's all. The last news will happen in Davos, Switzerland, next week, when President João Lourenço will meet the Portuguese Prime Minister, Mr. António Costa.
One would think that the President of Angola, Mr. Lourenço, is in favor of this trial because now that is good for his fight against corruption.
There are some kind of, I would say, some kind of barriers, because in the ruling party, the man in power is the former president, Mr. President Dos Santos. So Mr. João Lourenço doesn't have all the power in the ruling party. So there are some kind of transitions, and there are some kinds of managing of political transitions to follow up what will happen in the next stage. Mr. João Lourenço has some kind of power. He was elected, but he doesn't have the power in the ruling party. The power in the ruling party has been holding by the former president of the republic and now MPLA, the ruling party president, Mr. Dos Santos.
Mario Alpavais, a veteran Angolan journalist, he was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. Burundi's Batwa ethnic minority group says its members are still marginalized in accessing basic needs such as land, education, and health services. The Batwa are mostly Pygmy people who constitute 1% of Burundi's population. Moses Avia Rimana reports from Muramvya province in Burundi.
It was about 10 in the morning, local time, in Muramvya province, when I arrived in the Twa village. Normally, at this time, children are expected to be at school, but not all of the children can go to school of this community due to the poverty. The Twa ethnic group, commonly known as the Bushmen or Pygmies, remain the most marginalized community in Burundi. Bukayeni Zanadine is a 30-year-old mother of four children. She says that only one out of the four children go to school and that it is because of the poverty they can't afford to pay for the four children. Nadine says that let alone to pay school fees, but they sometimes don't get what to eat or only eat once a day. Unlike other villages in the country, where 90% of the Burundian population depend on farming, currently, besides crafts, The Pygmies heavily rely on loading sacks of charcoal and timber on trucks to earn a living. They say that they earn less than $1 to load a truck for the whole day. Barangenza Johan is a 53-year-old father of 8 children. He says, for them, the most important thing is to educate their children and that when they get the right education, they will be able to compete in the job market and be included in the government institutions. According to the Twa Association, only 20 people from the Twa ethnic group graduated since 1962 when the country gained its independence. Emmanuel Nengo is the representative of the Batwa in Burundi.
Batwa are part of the Burundian citizen. So for us, the marginalization, discrimination and the exclusion which Batwa are facing, we need the government to be involved on that issue. You will see that even the accords and also the laws, even the constitution, we are discriminated.
According to the locals in this village of more than 400 people, less than 30 children go to school. Burundi Human Rights Minister Martin Nivyabandi said that the government treats citizens equally and that the constitution doesn't discriminate anyone as all Burundians have equal rights. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Muramvya in Burundi.
Cape Town, South Africa, which has seen its worst drought in a century, could run out of water by April 22nd this year. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on what the so-called day zero would mean for the port city's tourism industry in general and its residents in particular.
Cape Town, which attracts about 2 million tourists a year, is facing its biggest water crisis ever. Mayor Patricia de Lille warned of a dire situation as drilling into one of the major aquifers under the city began last week.
We're losing 1% of our dams, 1.5 every week. Our dams for the first time is below 30%, and I'm really worried.
Residents will have to queue for water when water levels in the dams get too low. At a trial water collection site, people fill up their water bottles but are limited to a maximum 25 liters per person per day.
While we are working as hard as we can to bring additional water on board, Capetonians must help us to save water.
Something some residents are taking seriously as the so-called day zero in April approaches.
We definitely have to do our part and use as little water as possible. But I do hope that the government is doing something to prevent day zero, because it will be a national crisis. It will be honestly horrific.
We can't bath anymore. We can't. We must just shower, and because every other day we shower to save water. But we make do.
But one businessman wishes there were alternatives other than having to switch off all the taps and close his hotel when the city runs out of water.
There are countries in this world that have proven that there are ways to deal with drought and with desert regions. One has to look at the Middle East and see what Israel did to a desert there in respect of desalinization. And I know India are also doing a lot of good work with desalinization.
Cape Town is one of South Africa's hottest tourist destinations. About 9% of the country's $33 billion economic output last year came from the tourism industry, according to the World Travel and Tourism Council. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I am James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.